Okay, before I begin the lecture, do any of you have any questions you want to ask? Or okay, great. Today I'm going to be dealing with the coming of the Second World War in Europe in September of 1939. And let me begin by trying to put this in the context of what we're trying to do in this course as a whole. Our basic goal is to kind of get some insight into this fundamental question that lies at the heart of the whole international relations discipline. This is the whole problem of war and peace. What sort of insight of a general nature can we get into the question of what makes for war or for a stable international system? By studying history, by studying especially the great conflicts of the 20th century. The First World War, origins of the First World War in 1914. The coming of the Second World War in Europe, September of 1939. The expansion of the Second World War into a global war in 1941, especially the coming of the war in the Pacific, the U.S.-Japanese War in December of 1941. And then finally, in the second half of the course, the Cold War, both what caused it initially, what kept it alive, and what eventually led to its peaceful resolution. Right? The idea is by focusing like a laser on those great conflicts with these questions in mind. What do they tell us about the central issue, what makes for war or peace? We'll get some insight. Yeah?
The question is, the fact that people are studying this, doesn't it change the dynamics itself in the sense that people who study it have influence on the...
Everyone hear that question? It's the question is... If I can paraphrase, I talk as though the scholars, the observers, people like me, were just kind of totally outside the main thrust of events. But he says, isn't it the case that the kind of analyses that people make, the arguments that they develop, the conclusions they draw from studying these things, and the implications they draw from those conclusions about how policy should be conducted, doesn't this all feed back and have an impact on how events run their course, right? And it's like you all know the Heisenberg uncertainty principle from physics. It's the same sort of thing, right? A nice point, right? My answer to that is, I wish. That were the case. I wish it were the case that people who study these things seriously had a major impact on how things develop. There are various points in history where the scholars have played a role. They played a role in the misinterpretation of the Versailles Peace. They played a role in sorting out the whole question of the origins of the First World War. They played a certain role during the nuclear age, and as we'll see, you saw from the that piece I wrote about 1914, the kind of mistaken lessons that were drawn from what had led to the outbreak of the First World War played an important role in the nuclear age in shaping thinking about nuclear issues and especially about arms control issues. Yeah, the scholars play a role, but not a central role. I wish they did. I wish it had been the case that people like Kennan had a deeper impact than they actually had. By no means trivial, but you look at the course of American policy. All these arguments that scholars made, very critical Wilsonianism, what impact has it had? Very much on the margin, right? In any case, an interesting issue. It's not the core issue that we're concerned with today. We want to get some insight into the question of the origins of the Second World War in Europe, the European War of September of 1939, some insight into these central problems that define the whole field of international relations. Is this a war of aggression, pure and simple? When you look back at this whole story of what led to the outbreak of war in September 1939, you know, can you pretty much sum it up in, you know, these two words, Nazi aggressiveness, or even one word, Hitler? You know, is that what it all boils down to? Or, because that would suggest that, yeah, war can really result from aggression in the purest sense of the term. You know, it's nothing about the system, nothing about the international environment, you know, the other countries other than Germany. They were not agents in their own right who played an important role in shaping the story that culminated in the war. They were objects of German policy. They simply reacted. They didn't play a fundamental role in shaping the course of events, right? Except maybe through their moral weakness, right? Maybe they were craven. Maybe they were so appalled by what a war would mean that they just couldn't bring themselves to resist Germany. Those notions had, for many years, and still to a certain extent have, a resonance in the larger political culture. You know, people still view Munich as this kind of terrible thing. Appeasement is a terrible thing. You don't want to ever do it. And a lot of those notions about policy are rooted in a particular historical interpretation about what happened in the 1930s. They should have stopped Hitler early on. You know, it's like they were just so weak, so cowardly, that they just couldn't bring themselves to stand up to him. Whereas, you know, the Nazis were intent on war, and finally, you know, one thing led to another, and it reached the point where the Western powers felt they had just no choice, right? That view. As against that view, there's the whole idea that, things aren't quite that simple. Maybe German policy was shaped by the environment in which Germany found herself to a much greater degree than people made out. Indeed, maybe it was the case that Hitler didn't even want this war of September 1939. Maybe he didn't even view Munich, the Munich Agreement of 1938, as a great triumph. And if those things are the case, by the end of the lecture you'll see that they were the case, well, doesn't that have a fundamental impact on how we understand the whole story of 1939, the story of the origins of the Second World War? And if the war of 1939 isn't to be understood in terms of aggression, pure and simple, even in the case of a statesman as aggressive as Hitler, well, doesn't that have certain far-reaching, much more general implications about how international politics works with more normal statesmen? Right? All important points. So those are the issues we want to kind of bear in mind when we kind of look at the story. What was the point of the last few lectures? Again, focusing on the central issue, the issue of a realist interpretation of international politics, how it translates into particular historical interpretations of the interwar period, how the realist theory would lead you to think that statecraft is not the only thing that matters, human agency is not absolutely central, that structure, impersonal forces, play a very fundamental role in shaping the course of events, that moral judgments aren't so easy to make, that these issues are to be understood in terms of shades of gray rather than black and white. And to a certain extent, that approach was vindicated by a study of the pre-Nazi period. As a matter of fact, the point there about Stresemann's goals, that there's more continuity between the 20s and 30s than we had been led to believe. You know, these are important findings of historical analysis. The central political problem, the problem of German power, the problem of Germany's role in Europe, this had not been resolved by the events of the late 1920s, the events of the Locarno period. Locarno and the policies that it was associated with had not put the peace between Germany and her former enemies in the West on a truly stable basis. In fact, it was in large measure just a kind of a mirage. People wanted to believe that they had achieved peace, but in fact, the fundamental problems kind of persist. I have to say that, you know, again, the instinct of a realist analysis is to be very skeptical of these notions that everything, all international politics no longer is problematic, that that once you reach a certain point, you don't have to worry about the problem of power anymore. We have totally transformed the nature of the system. I mean, you saw these kind of arguments in the aftermath of the Cold War, when people were talking about the end of history, and people thought that you didn't have to worry about international politics anymore. It's like, you know, those arguments were kind of dubious at the time to people who had a realist sensibility. And you can see from the story of even the 1920s, before the Depression hit in 1930, that the fundamental problem had not been resolved. Right? And we saw also how there was a certain degree of continuity between the Stresemann policy, for example, and the policy that Hitler pursued in the early years, you know, building up German power, throwing off the shackles of Versailles, you know, intending to insist on territorial changes, especially in the East, but by no means limited to the East, right? But then, having said all those things, we had a drawback, say. Those structural considerations, the problem of power, those continuities and so on, yeah, they're of fundamental importance. But you can't reduce the story to things like that, because there are very fundamental differences between Stresemann and Hitler in two areas, the whole question of how far you want to go and how fast you intend to proceed. You know, what sort of risk are you willing to run? You know, moving ahead only when the general political conjuncture, the structure of power, is in your favor, so that you're not really running a serious risk of war, right? Hitler much more daring than Stresemann had been, right? And that willingness to run risk was to prove his undoing. Let's see. Okay, so there are big differences, but they're kind of they're suppressed in the initial years. Why are they suppressed? Because the Germans are still weak compared to the West. They're worried about a preventive war. They think that the West, they would be fools not to act against Germany, and so they want to do what they can to minimize the risk that they're running while they are still weak, while they are still building up their power. Right? And they do all these things to kind of pull the wool over people's eyes to the extent that they can. Right? In a sense, you know, all these efforts to make sure that they can make it through the danger zone safely weren't really all that necessary, because there wasn't much that the West was going to do against them in any case. But still, there was an element of caution to Nazi policy in the first few years, 1933, 34. Finally, in 1935, they begin to take a tougher line. They announced the reintroduction of conscription. They announced that they've built an air force, 1935 this is. In 1936, they take this key step, the remilitarization of the Rhineland, after taking their soundings and after seeing that there wasn't much that the West was going to do to prevent them from remilitarizing the Rhineland. Right? This is symbolized Germany's unequal status. Germans are intent on recovering their what they viewed as their equal rights in matters of armament, throwing off the shackles of Versailles. The West was not going to go to war to prevent them from doing so. And I told you last time remarkable story that Schuchert told in his article about the remilitarization of the Rhineland, about how the French thought that they could deter the Germans by saying, if you move into the Rhineland, we will take this matter to the League of Nations, and we will ask the League of Nations to impose economic sanctions on you. And the Nazi reaction was basically, this is wonderful, this is great, what did I say, break out the champagne, something like that. When the Rhineland was remilitarized and the Germans moved their troops in there and began building up fortifications, this changed the entire political equation, the military equation. France could no longer threaten Germany with an invasion in the event that Germany moved east. France had alliances with Poland and Czechoslovakia and Germany's east. But what would France be able to do if Germany moved east, especially now that the Rhineland was being defended? The French didn't have much in the way of offensive military forces in any case. Why? Because France didn't have all that much to spend on the military at the time. This is a time of depression. And what she was spending, on defensive armaments, of fortifications, on the Maginot Line. You know, this period of the late 1930s, this is when the young 18-year-old conscripts who would have been born during the period of the First World War, they would have come of age for military service, but they hadn't been born because their fathers had all been wiped out during the war. The French had an expression for this, les années creuses, the empty years. The number of young men who were eligible for military service was very small. Smaller in proportion than it was for Germany or for England, where the demographic effect of the war wasn't nearly so extreme. Right? So the military situation was moving very rapidly in Germany's favor. Full speed ahead in armaments. The Western powers were not rearming anything like the same rate. There was this problem. The West really found it very hard to make a serious alliance with the Soviet Union. They didn't like Nazi Germany, but they certainly didn't like Soviet Russia. And other countries could see which way the wind was blowing. You have Italy changing its policy, from anti-German to becoming, in effect, a satellite of Germany, aligning itself with Germany. In the hope that Italy could become a partner with Germany. Belgium moving away from alliance with the West to a policy of neutrality. You have the sense that the Western powers are now going to have their hands full dealing with Germany, and the West is kind of overextended and can't take a tough line in other parts of the world. So these problems are very much bound up with Japan's opting for an increasingly aggressive policy. The beginning of the Japanese war against China in 1937 has to be understood in this context. All these things are interconnected. The Italian expansionism in the Horn of Africa and Ethiopia, again, very much to be understood in the context of the West really can't pick a quarrel with Italy, given that she has to focus on a much more serious problem, namely Germany. Right? So that's the backdrop of what's going on in the post-1936 period. And Hitler's going to take advantage of this. Does this mean that he wants war with the West? No! He does not want a war with the West. His goal is to create a great German empire in the East, in the direction of the Ukraine. That's the target for German territorial expansion. And his feeling is, if the West is prepared to live with that, he's more than willing to live with the status quo in the West. You know, France too weak to pose any real threat. British Empire, well, the British overseas interests. He's prepared. Even he says to guarantee the British Empire. Doesn't want a war with Britain. Big mistake that the imperial regime had made before 1914 in picking a quarrel with the British. You know, the whole area of challenging British naval preeminence? No way, you know. Germany's not going to want to do that. Germany accepts British naval preeminence. It's the meaning of the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, 1935. You know? And Hitler senses countries behave in accordance with their fundamental interests, as long as Britain and France are not being threatened directly by Germany. If they're willing to give Germany a free hand in the East, he's willing to let them be in the West. He doesn't want a war with them, right? When he sends one of his top collaborators, Ribbentrop, over to London as the German ambassador in London, he says to Ribbentrop, bring me back the British alliance. This is what he wants. Even a free hand for Eastern expansion. This would be plenty. Okay. And to his amazement, to his utter astonishment, the British are not forthcoming to these. You know, from his point of view, he's perfectly honest. You know, he wants to expand in the East. All he wants from the West is for him to lay off and let him do it. But the British are unwilling to accept that. You say, well, why not? Once again, you can see the importance of power considerations in shaping foreign policy. If the British allow Germany a free hand in the East, and Germany did proceed to develop this great continental empire in the East, controlling all the resources of Eastern Europe, massive territorial base extending, to the whole area of the Black Sea. German power would increase to such a point that the independence of Britain would be compromised. The Britain would necessarily be reduced to the status of a German satellite. Britain would be forced to live in the shadow of German power. You know, it's like that's the end of British freedom. This very basic concept that had shaped British policy for centuries, ever since the 16th century, when the British were very concerned about Habsburg domination of Europe and dealing with Philip II of Spain and so on. Their involvement in European affairs was governed by the desire to prevent the resources of Europe from being organized and controlled by one single power, which could mobilize those resources and develop so much military strength, including naval strength, that Britain could be threatened with invasion and Britain would lose her independence, if not her national identity, pure and simple. So the British are bound to oppose what Hitler wants. Hitler's kind of amazed by this, however. He says, they didn't oppose me when I was weak, when it was would have been relatively easy for them to, put a stop to what I was doing. He said, it's not rational for them to oppose me now that I'm strong. Surely, if I make it seem that there's a real risk of war, they will wake up. They'll pursue a more sober policy. They'll be willing to accept the sort of arrangement that I'm offering to them. It doesn't happen. I mean, I should say, it's important to see British policy for what it was. In the post-World War II period, the whole history of British policy prior to 1939 was written essentially by Winston Churchill, who had been a big enemy of the government of the day headed by Neville Chamberlain. And Churchill, after he was thrown out of office, after having won the Second World War, he sat down and he wrote his great history of the Second World War. And the first volume in that history was on the origins of the war. It's called The Gathering Storm. It came out in 1948, a very interesting book. And Churchill's basic argument was something fundamentally wrong with British policy. It's morally weak. They had no conception of national honor, of national interest. They were like ostriches with their heads in the sand. You know, they should have seen this German problem and basically taken a strong line right from the start, not engaged in this policy of appeasement, of giving the Germans what they were asking for in the hope that the German problem would go away. That was so naive. That was just so craven. Right? Okay. Eventually, historians had access to all kinds of evidence about British policy in this period. And that whole view of what Chamberlain was up to has been totally transformed. I'll tell you a lot about this stuff in the course of the lecture today. One of the scholars who did the most interesting work in this area, his name is R.S.E. Parker, and he wrote this book called Chamberlain and Appeasement. And this is what he concluded after some very serious study of Chamberlain. He said, Chamberlainite appeasement was not a feeble policy of surrender and unlimited retreat. Chamberlain thought war futile and rejected it, but never pursued peace at any price. His policy meant intervention in continental Europe to induce Hitler's Germany to insist only on expansion so limited that it would not threaten the safety or independence of the United Kingdom. In retrospect, this appears a bold, venturesome policy, certain, given the ambitions of Hitler, to lead to an Anglo-German war. Wow, that's a rather different view from the view that Churchill wanted us to hold. Okay? Chamberlain wasn't against change in the territorial status quo. He felt that certain changes were warranted. Certainly the German-Polish frontier had to be changed. Yeah. And he was willing to help bring about those changes, providing they were done peacefully, without resort to war, and providing that they were limited in accordance with what the British could accept. When this became clear to the Germans, they reacted. It's like, who are the British to tell us what we can and cannot do? They're not our nanny. They're not, our governess that could, slap us when we get out of line. Right? They have to treat us as equals. They have to give us a free hand. And when it was clear that Chamberlain was not going to give the British a free hand, that Hitler's view about Britain changed. There's a very important document. It's known in the historical literature as the Hossbach Memorandum. Right? The Hossbach Memorandum of November 1937 recorded Hitler's comments at a meeting with the top German military leadership. And he basically referred to Britain and France as hate-inspired adversaries. I mean, the very term is revealing, because he's saying these people are not rational. If they were rational, they would accept what Germany was offering them. But they're inspired by hate against us. They want to kind of keep us down. And he says, and because of that, he thought war with Britain and France was inevitable. Right? And in this and in related documents, he revealed what he considered to be the period at which the war would break out, 1943 to 1945. He didn't want it before then. In fact, he didn't want it at all. But he was willing. He came to the conclusion that it was inevitable. He wanted to put it off until the distant future when Germany was so strong that she could face a war with the Western powers with confidence. Okay. And what should German policy be in the meantime? To prepare for such a war. To clear the decks in the East. To make sure that Germany had access to the resources of the East when she had to face the Western powers in a war. Just the Western powers, not the Soviet Union. He didn't believe that they would be able to get together. Okay. And so you find Germany now focusing on clearing up these problems in the East. What are the problems in the East? Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. And in rapid succession, you have the Austrian crisis of early 38, the Czech crisis of mid and late 38, and the Polish crisis of 1939. Austrian crisis? Well, the shift in the European balance of power, you know, which we associate especially with the remilitarization of the Rhineland, had an effect on the local Nazis in Austria. It created a great deal of excitement, and now they could move ahead. Especially since Italian policy, which had opposed them in 1934, Italian policy had now shifted. Right? And so you have the Austrian Nazis agitating for, you know, more and more control within Austria. And Hitler very much wanted to see that process develop without the direct use of German force. He did not want to actually have to invade Austria for fear of inflaming opinion in the West and making it harder for him to achieve his goals. He always wanted to kind of isolate his adversaries. And it seemed that that strategy was working. It seemed that the Austrian government, which is not a democratic government, it was a kind of a fascist, clerical sort of government, not Nazi, but much more particularist, they were willing to kind of grant the Austrian Nazis more and more control within Austria. Okay? But it came to the point where the Austrian leadership realized that unless it took action, Austria would be essentially taken over by Germany, and that would be the end of Austrian independence. So the Austrian Chancellor, Schuschnigg, his name was, he called for a plebiscite on the whole issue of the independence of Austria. This, you know, infuriated Hitler because if a plebiscite resulted in the strengthening of Schuschnigg's position, which it probably would since plebiscites were not totally free, then it would make it much harder for Germany to take over Austria. But he wanted Austria, you know, another 10 million people or so, ethnically German. He himself was an Austrian by birth. And so he was provoked into action. He hadn't planned the Austrian crisis, you know, but he was responding to Schuschnigg, who was responding to this policy of the kind of organic incorporation of Austria into Germany gradually. Okay, and so the Germans improvised the invasion, welcomed very enthusiastically by the Austrian people when it happened, but there were all these embarrassing incidents of tanks breaking down on the roads from Germany into Austria. It shows that the whole episode was improvised. But the point is that by early 38, Germany had taken over Austria, had now annexed Austria. This is called the Anschluss of Austria, the annexation of Austria. Okay? Once again, you can see how this changes the strategic situation. Now that the Germans are in Austria, look who's surrounded. The Bohemian heartland of Czechoslovakia. You know, there's Prague, right in the middle there. You know, surrounded on three borders, in the west, in the north, and in the south. You know, it's like, oh, now's the time to start putting pressure on the Czechs. What does Hitler want? He wants a little war against Czechoslovakia. He wants to take over all of Czechoslovakia and needs a war in order to do that. How does he proceed? He wants to put his demands so high that the Czechs couldn't accept them, but so low that the British and French would not go to war for the sake of Czechoslovakia. Right? France had an alliance with Czechoslovakia. The British felt like if France went to war with Germany over Czechoslovakia, they would be drawn in because they couldn't afford to see France crushed. So all of these events, together with instructions from Berlin, lead the local Nazis within the German population in Czechoslovakia to begin agitating against the authorities in Prague. Where do these people live? They live in the Sudeten Mountains, which are the borderland of Czechoslovakia. Mountains are important strategically because it's harder for an army to pass through a mountain barrier than to proceed along flatlands. And the question was, how are you going to deal with the Sudeten problem? You know, if the Czechs kind of came down on the Sudetens and there were armed clashes, the Germans would use this as an excuse for military intervention. You know, the problem was very clear. The Allies had this principle of self-determination. You know, didn't the Germans have a right to have the principle of self-determination applied when it worked in their favor and not just when it worked against them? Right. So Chamberlain was willing to consider changes here, and in fact to put pressure on the Czechs to accept these changes, providing they were done peacefully. And as this crisis is building up, Chamberlain, his own initiative, flies off to meet Hitler at his mountain retreat in Bavaria. It's called Berchtesgaden. The Germans are only told that Chamberlain was about to come, like practically when just a little bit before his plane was actually in the air. And so Hitler and Chamberlain meet, and they reach what Chamberlain thought was an agreement on September 15th, 1938. And this is that half of areas that were inhabited by at least 50% ethnic Germans would be cut off from Czechoslovakia and transferred to the German Reich, annexed by Germany, right? Czechs were more or less made to accept this. There would be no war, and the Nazis wouldn't control the kind of Bohemian heartland of Czechoslovakia or Slovakia, the eastern part of the country. And Chamberlain thought he had a deal. And then he gets the rest of his cabinet, he gets the French and the Czechs to kind of go along with this. And to his amazement, when he goes back to Germany to kind of seal the deal, he meets Hitler at Godesberg in the Rhineland 2 weeks later. Is October 1st. Hitler is up the ante. Hitler now takes out a map and says and just lays out his demand that these are the areas that are going to have to be transferred. No plebiscite, no attempt to assess, those areas where 50% of the population is ethnic German. Hitler's laying down the law. And Chamberlain was willing to swallow even this, but the majority of his cabinet, Britain has a cabinet system, don't forget, not a presidential system where it's not like the prime minister could just lay down the law. The cabinet bridles. And the key figure here is the foreign secretary, Lord Halifax. No, we're not going to accept this. This is an ultimatum. It's just too far. Hitler, rather than accept this, we're going to have to go to war with Germany, right? And so there's a third meeting. The Germans don't want a war with the West at this point. A meeting is held in Munich. A compromise is reached. War is avoided. Chamberlain comes back and he says, I've achieved peace with honor. Right? The important thing is Hitler had backed off. Hitler viewed this as a big defeat. Hitler paid a price in terms of his standing within the German establishment for having backed off. And Chamberlain viewed it as a victory. Hitler has missed the bus, he said. Okay. All of this sets the stage for the next crisis. I should tell I have a little bit of time. I'll tell you a little bit more about how historical interpretation of the Munich Agreement has changed over time. Like I said, the initial interpretation is laid out by Churchill in The Gathering Storm was that this is just moral weakness, this is cravenness on the part of Chamberlain. Appeasement was a terrible policy. When the archives opened up and historians had a chance to kind of explore the thinking of the key figures shaping British policy in this period, they reached some very different conclusions, and it's laid out very nicely in one of the articles I put on the course website. On all these things are recommended. You don't have to read them, but if you're interested in this stuff, take a look at this article by Paul Schrader. This is what Schrader says. If one begins to tot up all the plausible motivations for appeasement, fear and horror of another war, Britain's state of military unpreparedness, fear for the British economy and the empire, the unprepared state of public opinion, the isolationism of the Dominions and the United States, lack of confidence in France, lack of interest in Central Europe, failure to understand Hitler and Nazism, fear and distrust of the Soviet Union and communism, the absence of a viable alternative presented either by the conservative opposition or labor, and more. One sees that these are far more than enough to explain it. It was massively overdetermined. Any other policy in 1938 would have been an astounding, almost inexplicable divergence from the norm. You know, quite an extraordinary revision of historical interpretation. Okay. The changes that were effected as a result of the Munich Agreement set the stage for 1939. As I say, Hitler felt cheated out of his war. He has one last big item on the agenda in the East, and this is Poland. He doesn't want to treat Poland as an enemy. He actually feels more warmly about the Poles than he did about the Czechs. He wants Poland to be kind of a junior partner for Germany in the great crusade that was being prepared against the Soviet Union. But the Poles resist these blandishments because even if that policy succeeded, they would necessarily be simply satellites of Nazi Germany. What can Hitler do to bring the Poles around? Well, he could bribe them. He could offer to give them territory at the expense of what was Czechoslovakia. And so this is one of the factors that leads Hitler in March of 1939 to seize the remnant of Czechoslovakia, now utterly defenseless. Right? And so Hitler basically takes over both the Czech part and the Slovak part of Czechoslovakia, you know, partly with the goal of being able to use that territory as bait for bringing the Poles on board. Okay, this this development, the Nazi seizure of Prague, March 1939, German takeover, the rest of Czechoslovakia, in March of 1939, of enormous importance. This is one of the things everyone should know. The dramatic effect that this had in transforming British opinion and in discrediting appeasement and providing the basis for the policy of resistance. Why was it so important? Because up to this point, everything Hitler had done could be rationalized by appeal to the principle of self-determination. And now Hitler was saying that it wasn't just Germans that he wanted to control. His ambitions would not be limited by that basic consideration. Right? And now the British public is inclined to resistance. What's interesting is that even before this, in January of 1939, the dominant faction in the British government, not Chamberlain himself, but the faction led by Lord Halifax, had reached the conclusion that if Hitler remained in power, Anglo-German war by the end of the year was pretty much inevitable. Okay? To a certain extent, that conclusion was based on what we would now call preventive war thinking. See, the British had embarked on a massive rearmament campaign. They felt that as a democracy, they couldn't keep that up indefinitely. You know, if war was inevitable, it would be better to have it at a time when Britain was relatively strong rather than wait until the British economy was exhausted, peacetime economy couldn't sustain this buildup, and Germany would become a much more formidable threat. Those ideas are in the minds of these people, no question about it, and it's part of the reason they opted for a policy of toughness, a policy basically of guaranteeing the Poles against German aggression. You know, basically giving the Poles the wherewithal to resist these German blandishments. They can now count that the Western powers would come to their aid. So the Poles resist. Hitler could scarcely believe it. They resist because the British are backing them up. He thinks the British are bluffing. The British aren't going to want to go to war. I saw those worms at Munich, he says. Right? They talk big, but when the crisis really begins to bite, then they're going to look for a way out. And so the key thing is to deter the West from intervening by ratcheting up the level of German commitment. And the West, for its part, also believes that its only hope, if there's any hope of avoiding war, perhaps by the generals getting rid of Hitler, is by making it clear that they're utterly committed, that they're determined to resist. Right? And each side digs itself in deeper and deeper, hoping that the strength of its commitment is going to deter the other side. But in fact, what you have is both sides, you know, becoming increasingly committed to a course of action that is going to lead to this clash. And when push comes to shove, Germany is in far too deep to pull back. Right? And the British are not going to pull back either. That's how the outbreak of the war in September was to be understood. And this was seen by Raymond Sontag, the author of the Broken World book that you're reading for this course. He was editor-in-chief of the Captured German Documents. And he wrote in 1957 an important article, drawing on the results of those historical investigations. And I'll just read a couple of things in the minute or so remaining. He says, from the tangle of evidence, one theme emerges, a theme which has relevance to our own day. It's the way in which a succession of diplomatic moves intended only as preparatory to a still distant trial of strength developed into a diplomatic crisis involving all of Europe. and eventually precipitated a world war which at the outset Hitler had no thought of starting and which to the end he hoped to avoid. Okay? So if that's true, even of a statesman as aggressive as Hitler, if that's true, even of the outbreak of the Second World War in Europe, well, that point tells you something of fundamental importance about how the coming of war is to be understood. Not in terms of aggression, pure and simple, but as the outcome of a process in which more than one side is calling the shots. Okay? So let me end with that point. Next time, bring the Taylor book. And those of you who are listening at home, bring, follow the lecture next time with the Taylor book in front of you, because I'm going to point to chapter and verse in that book. Lecture next time is probably the most important lecture in the whole course. So bring the Taylor book with you.